CTV News with Lloyd Robertson.
Tonight on Global National.
This is All News Radio.
When we look at local news, historically we think of television, a community radio station, or a newspaper. Fostering a healthy and diverse newsroom is critical to the development of society, democracy. In the U.S., the Washington Post uses the tagline, "Democracy dies in darkness." Local news is often the lifeline to being aware of politics, the economy, even everyday events in the arts. And if it's so important, why is local news in such desperate need of help? A media study commissioned by the Canadian Association of Broadcasters, published in August 2020, projected significant closures of newsrooms, widespread job cuts, and an estimated revenue shortfall of over $1 billion by the end of 2022. Traditional newsrooms are funded by local advertising, but with revenue shifting to Facebook, Google, and Instagram, TV, print, and radio all have to evolve to keep up with the times. So what is the solution? How do we preserve and sustain local news in Canada? I'm Winston Tse, a journalist who spent a decade working in and studying local media. And in this audio series, Staying Alive, each episode will discuss the trends, the issues, the business, and the opportunities to create a diverse and sustainable future for local journalism. Our starting point today is understanding the issues, how it started, and how it's going. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a profound impact on journalism, and someone who's tracked local journalism trends closely is a journalist herself. April Lindgren is a Ryerson University School of Journalism professor and the principal investigator for the Local News Research Project, exploring local news poverty, where the critical information needs of communities are not being addressed by local media. April, it's a pleasure to have you on.
It's great to be here.
So I wanted to start with taking a look at the trends and direction. And when we take a look at the entertainment industry, there seems to be a clear direction with the launch of so many different streaming services. It seems like every day there's another one. But local news doesn't seem to be as clear with where that direction is going. So through your work with the Local News Research Project, what are some of the trends you're seeing today?
Well, I think the dominant trend and the one we're all struggling to come to terms with has been the loss and decline of local news media in communities across the country. So I run something called the Local News Map, and what we've been doing with that map is tracking what's closed and what's open in terms of local news media at the local level. And we picked 2008 as the starting date because there was a recession at that point that really took the wind out of the sails of a lot of news organizations. And then we've gone forward from there. So our latest data from April 1st shows that since 2008, 448 local news operations have closed in 323 communities across the country. So to put that in perspective, you could say, well, gosh, maybe everybody's starting their digital startups everywhere, sprouting up like flowers across the country. But sadly, that's not the case. We're seeing closings at about twice the rate of new operations opening. And we're seeing another trend in the loss of community papers. And unfortunately, we're not seeing a huge burgeoning of digital news operations, although there are some, and there are some really innovative and interesting projects happening.
And then you combine that with continued media convergence, and you take a look at newspapers, radio, television. Media convergence is happening everywhere.
Yeah, well, it's convergence, but it's also shrinking. So there's kind of two things that are happening. Like in a number of cases where we mark down a news organization as closed, it's because there's been a merger with another newspaper, for instance, or it's been acquired and there's two papers in the same market and the new owner decides to get rid of one of them. So, you know, people might say, well, so it doesn't matter. There's still a newspaper left, or there's still a TV station left, but it's primarily happening in the print media, this convergence issue. But the fact is, when you only have one left, you're completely reliant upon them as a resident of those communities. So instead of getting a few different perspectives on what's happening at City Hall or on whether, you know, the police are doing a good or bad job, you're now stuck with one voice or fewer voices and fewer perspectives on that. And it matters because news organizations and what they cover, they vary. and they have different columnists who have different perspectives in terms of writing opinion. They have reporters who see news in places where other reporters don't see news. So it just means a community is not as well served. And what we've seen with the pandemic is that it's accelerated quite a number of trends, in particular clothing. So we started actually a separate map because we thought that the pandemic impacts were so dramatic. We wanted to create kind of a window that looked just at what's happened since March 2020, when the World Health Organization declared the pandemic. 67 media outlets have closed temporarily or permanently, and of those, 40 for sure have permanently shut down. So that's 29 community papers, 5 radio stations, 4 online news operations, and 2 television stations. And I think we're not through with the impact of what COVID-19 has done to the local news sector. And it's also accelerated the shift to digital. So 49 media outlets, including 30 community papers, 15 dailies, and 4 magazines have canceled or suspended all or some of their print editions.
When you look at these print outlets switch to a digital only operation so quickly, it seems like it's a knee-jerk reaction and less so of a nuanced approach where you're transitioning in a digital presence and building that audience. And they do it so quickly and they see that there's the audience, they're not just going to flock over to their website when there's so much more content online. And then you start to see these websites shutter, and then you're left with these news deserts where communities are seeing complete loss of news representation and coverage. Do you have any sense of where some of the biggest pockets are across the country right now?
We know in a place like Toronto that since 2008, 20 local news operations have closed and 4 have launched. Same in Ottawa. They also lost 20 local news sources and 7 have launched. But the point is there are still local coverage. There are survivors in terms of local media in those communities. Whereas when you get down to smaller and smaller places, there might only be 1 or 2 options available. And so what those communities are experiencing is the loss of their truly local news community paper because it's been merged with 3 papers in the sort of the region, or it has disappeared completely. Winston, I think what people forget about when we just think about closings is that there's something almost as problematic, and that's the idea of a ghost news organization. For instance, in the case of a newspaper, it's there, it publishes, but there's not much news in there. So those critical needs that we were talking about, information needs that people have to manage in daily life, isn't being provided because these news organizations are so limited in terms of the coverage that they do. I think one of the things that kind of puts in perspective those losses has been our data from the map on the pandemic and other information that we've gathered. And it shows that almost 3,000 workers from media have been cut in Canada at different media organizations. Now, be careful. This is both editorial people who work in newsrooms and non-editorial. So the people who would be selling advertising to pay the people who work in newsrooms. There have been significant job losses in terms of the announcements of layoffs. Of those 3,000, we know for sure that 1,200 are permanent.
Wow.
We've been able to confirm about 1,200. Again, not all journalists by a long stretch, but still it speaks to the capacity of those news organizations to produce and support the production of content that people need to participate in local politics, to work together on local projects, and even to build a sense of community, because that's what local journalism does, is it brings people together through a shared, well, vicariously shared experience. You know, what we all watch the story on TV and we can talk about it over the back fence, or we all read the story in the newspaper or we saw it online.
Mm-hmm. And you know, when we look at these online news outlets, whether that's legacy news outlets that are typically anchored in advertising, local journalism, when it comes to online presence now, they're continuing to struggle to find a profitable model. And we've seen experimentation with freemium models where there's some free content and then they'll put up a paywall and they'll want you to pay at some point, or completely advertisement-based while others rely on subscriptions. Is there a model that you're more inclined to gravitate towards as a consumer?
I do have some concerns with the whole concept of the paywall and free content for some parts of what's offered and having to pay for the other stuff, other content, because it does create inequities in terms of who has access to the best information. within our society, right? So you think about the people who are excluded from, say, the best information on where to get vaccinated. And it says to me that because I paid my subscription, I'm going to have access to all of that content, whereas somebody who's just counting on whatever the news organization decides it's going to make available for free doesn't. Now, to a certain extent, that's a choice. You know, people are choosing not to spend money on subscriptions. But there are certain people, and arguably you could make the case that it's the people who need this information the most, because they might not have the networks or the social networks to access this kind of information, are the people who are most likely to be disadvantaged by lack of access to an equal playing field, let's say, in terms of what journalism is offering.
And the issue of access is also amplified by big tech. When you look at Facebook and Google and Apple News, you know, they all kind of want to have their sticky fingers all over journalism as well. But there's no magic formula for what is a successful local newsroom today.
No, there isn't. And how to get there. I mean, the truth is the business model broke when advertising was siphoned off by the platforms, when classified ads disappeared before that. And news organizations, we are still actually struggling to figure out how to replicate that. Now, some news organizations have succeeded, if you're the Washington Post or the New York Times, because they have massive appeal to audiences far beyond their cities where they're located in. So they can sell advertising on that basis, and they have been able to build subscriptions like that. But if you operate a small news organization with, say, in a town of 20,000 people, you know, the chances that people in Ottawa are going to want to subscribe to your little news organization, and if you live in a community in Western Canada, is probably pretty limited. So the potential to sort of grow your advertising dollars in that way is, I think, a structural challenge that news organizations face, small local news organizations face. I mean, that's not to say there aren't some other options, but I mean, I think it's a challenge.
Now, the CBC recently has seen some criticism over implementing these branded content units. We're seeing a rise in sponsored content, and it's not just the CBC, Bell, Rogers, they're all doing it. Is there an issue with these kinds of initiatives?
I think there's a huge issue. It's really, really bad for journalism. I mean, it might be good for the business side of things, but I mean, we have one thing to sell as a news organization, and that's our credibility. And the truth of the matter is, study after study has shown that news organizations have not done a good job of making it clear what's branded content and what isn't. And anyway, just think about it. Branded content, what's the average person know what branded content is? What it should say is the business featured in this story paid for the story. Mm-hmm. Then people know what the story's about, but there's a real reluctance to do that for obvious reasons.
There's a sneakiness where it's being buried in the last sentence of a piece of content so that in hopes that, you know, someone doesn't actually see it at all.
Yeah, and that in an era when trust is a huge problem for us as in the news business, in journalism, I shouldn't say the news business, in journalism, what we really need is for people to build a relationship with our audiences where people can trust us to be doing what we're supposed to do as journalists, which is to produce verified, timely, independently produced journalism. And that independently produced part is I think, really compromised by the branded content.
Now, diversity and representation in Canadian content should always be a part of content strategy, but for so long, it's taken a backseat to profit and ratings and arguably corporate interests when we're talking about vertically integrated companies and branded content. Now, your work is mostly centered around local news, but you have published some really important work when it comes to diversity in Canadian ethnic newsrooms as well. So I did want to touch upon that. Is diversity in the newsroom growing in the right direction because we are living in a time where race and representation are critical to the stories that we tell?
I think there is a growing awareness of why we need to do this in terms of better serving our audiences and providing journalism that is more relevant and speaks to a broader range of people. The pandemic, I think, has been a setback. So I'm thinking, for instance, of the demise of Huffington Post Canada, HuffPo Canada. There were a lot of young journalists, and by definition, the younger cohort of journalists is more diverse because it's a reflection of Canada, where we have much more diverse population than we did in my generation. And a lot of these young journalists were getting their start at a place like HuffPo, and all of a sudden those jobs disappeared. So I think that does represent a serious setback. Having said that, I do think there's a growing recognition that it produces better journalism when you have more diverse news. So my hope is that moving forward, this will be recognized and embraced by more and more news organizations. And I think there's opportunities for things like the Local Journalism Initiative, which is a federal policy that's helping, will subsidize the cost of a journalist to work in a newsroom to cover an undercovered subject in terms of the reporting of that newsroom. On the broadcast side, they are required, actually, to incorporate a more diverse workforce into their newsrooms in terms of their hosts and reporters and that sort of thing. And there's been no equivalent of that in newsrooms at, say, newspapers, for instance. Now, what I'm arguing is that something like the Local Journalism Initiative, which is $10 million a year going into hiring journalists to cover undercover topics at media across the country, could be a way to make sure that the pool of hiring is more diverse. And to be fair, it hasn't been in place long enough for us to take a look at who actually is getting those jobs. But I think it's a question we need to ask, because it is one way of in giving people experience so that maybe they don't stay on at that news organization, but they've got valuable experience that would be attractive to other places.
Well, I want to end on some optimism here, because I think there is a lot of optimism in the journalism industry. Final thoughts, where do you see areas of opportunity when it comes to innovation? You know, you've mentioned to me that there's a lot of exciting experimentation that's happening in journalism in Canada.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that COVID has been really challenging in terms of the impact on the news business. And it's certainly been challenging on a personal level for many, many journalists who have never worked harder than their lives on a story that's been more important than this, literally life and death issues. If I had to find any sort of silver lining in the pandemic cloud, bleak and dark as they are, it's that it's demonstrated how important local journalism is. Now, I do think that, you know, for all I spend a lot of time tracking the doom and gloom statistics of closings and the relatively few openings, that there's a lot of experimentation going on in trying to figure out a replacement for that broken business model that I talked about earlier. So new rules, for instance, are going to allow nonprofit news organizations that qualify under Revenue Canada rules to take donations and give you a tax receipt if you give them a donation. You know, we're late getting into this business in the United States. There are hundreds of nonprofit news organizations in Canada. You can kind of count them on one hand. But, you know, I'm hearing about, people have already contacted me about possibilities for nonprofit news ideas that they have for launching operations. There's a newsletter model that's gaining in popularity where a news organization basically just produces a newsletter and convinces people to let them drop it into their inbox every day or every afternoon. I think partnerships with journalism schools have also proven to be very successful. And I would mention the Institute for Investigative Journalism. It's run out of Concordia, but it's basically a collaboration between all the journalism schools across the country and news organizations. I think there's also potential for membership, which is basically a nice way of saying, give us a donation. But, you know, we're going to build a relationship with you as a news as our audience. And I actually think that that's good for journalism, too, because, I mean, it just means that, you know, people who need the content for free can get it for free, but other people will become members and maybe they'll get invited to an event where they can hear a journalist speak or they can contribute an idea to a story file if they have some ideas. And then we have, you know, the Toronto Star wanting to get a casino and use that to fund their news operations. So read the news, bet on a hand, blackjack.
Well, I couldn't think of anything more 2021 than funding your newsroom with the creation of a casino. You know, that's something that you never would have imagined many, many years ago. So just another sign of the times. And I also really like that you mentioned and acknowledging the fact that so many journalists have been working remotely from their living rooms and from their kitchen islands to bring this critical information to Canadians. That certainly isn't easy, but is so, so important. important. So thank you so much for mentioning that. And on that note, we are out of time. April Lindgren, thanks so much for joining. This really sets the scene for the upcoming episodes.
Well, it's been really a great pleasure to talk about this, Winston. So I hope there's going to be better news to report in the future on all fronts.
Agreed. Thank you so much, April. April Lindgren is a professor at the Ryerson University School of Journalism and, of course, the principal investigator for the Local News Research Project. And as we continue to dive into the future of local news, next episode, we take a look at the business of local news with the Canadian media executive and president of CPAC, Colette Watson, and her unique experience leading television operations at Rogers Media and positioning with the CRTC. I hope you'll join me then. I'm Winston C.